Welcome all. Welcome any new people we have with us tonight as guests. If you want to become a member, I've pasted into the chat where you can go to join up, or you can just go to our homepage at opcug.ca and click on the join or renew at the top, and that'll take you through where you can join up. But feel free to continue as a guest with us as often as you like. And with that, I will pass it on to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Okay, thank you very much, Chris. We have quite a range of material tonight. And starting off with a question that came in from Steve Parker. And he wants to know, how does a bootloader actually work? And what happens between you pressing the power button and until the desktop is ready to use? And the long answer to this is actually long and really quite technical. However, for those who are really interested in how bootloaders work, I highly recommend our buddy Dave Plummer, the retired Microsoft software engineer. This How Computers Boot is a really good explanation for both BIOS systems and for UEFI. So he covers all of the history of bootloaders, basically right up to modern times. So if you're interested in that aspect of technical things, that's a really good starting point. Okay, and next up, last week we had a poll, and this week Chris has the results.
Yeah, okay, so we, Alan, if you want to give me slide control. The questions we asked last week, they all came from Perplexity AI. Alan had asked, what are the 10 most frequently asked questions about using Windows? And the thought behind this was we often ask what people want to know about Windows, and we'll perhaps be able to include it in a future Q&A. And we very rarely get anything, and I think it comes an awful lot from people not knowing what they don't know. And so how do you know what to ask? And so we put this up as a poll, as these are frequently asked questions about using Windows. And 27 people did respond, and thank you all to those who responded. And Alan, if you'll advance once, I think I know what's going on this, but I think as soon as you advance once, I'm good to go. Okay, so here is the results of the survey. So out of the 27 respondents, 19 very heavily weighted on managing privacy and security settings. We often talk about that at Q&A, so it'd be great to continue that conversation, and followed closely by backup and recovery and improving performance. And then, as you can see, the frequency of the respondents to the other questions were a little bit lower, but still significant. And so we'll take this to heart. Alan has already got presentation on tonight, which is going to be starting the conversation about backup and recovery. And I certainly am going to look into a little bit more about managing privacy and security settings and some of the other ones as well. So I think from there, we have a call to action. So we're going to need presentations, or, you know, they can be longer presentations as well, on any or all of those topics. Now, you don't have to be an expert. All you have to do is maybe have some ideas, or even just covering part of it. So when we talk about, you know, security issues and things like that, well, it's pretty broad. So if you have anything that you wanted to share that just covers a snippet of that, that's great. I mean, we don't have to be all exhaustive. So any of those topics or any other topics that come to mind, but in particular those 10, if you have anything that you wanted to share with the rest of the group, please let us know at suggestionbox@opcug.ca, and we will reserve time at a future Q&A on that. And that's it for the survey, unless anybody had any questions about the survey.
Nothing in the chat right now, but if you have questions, put them in the chat. There is a question there from Carol. She wants to know what is a bootloader? And you have to watch the video, I guess. No, basically when you turn your computer on, there's some circuitry which basically starts things running. And eventually then it will load some code into the computer and execute it, and that is basically called a bootloader, because it pulls itself up from it by its bootstraps and actually starts the computer. So it's there's areas in memory which are reserved, and the CPU knows how to get to them, and then this bootloader code will basically load the file system, load the operating system, load the kernel, do all kinds of wonderful things, and your machine springs to life, and that's basically what a bootloader is for. Anyway, Dex Plummer explains it much more on that and in much more detail.
You won't get into the grubby details?
Correct. Yeah, because that's a startup menu. It's not a bootloader. Stuart Bruce sent us this thing on Patch Tuesday. He likes to run Patch My PC, which is basically a software updater. And he points out that now the developers of this program have a blog, which they call Patch Tuesday Blog. And basically what they're doing is detailing all of the patches which Microsoft releases when you get Windows updates. And he says it's a bit overwhelming for him, but it might be useful for others. And sure enough, if you go and look at the website, I mean, you have some big numbers there, how many patches are released and how many of them are critical. And then there's a whole raft of stuff further down about individual patches. And if you scroll down there, lots of KB articles, these information on individual patches. And at some point, you'll also find charts and tables and more numbers. And by the month. So I think this is what Stuart referred to as being overwhelming. There's a lot of stuff there. And you really have to dig into it if you want to know what's going on. Anyway, for what it's worth, if you need to know about specific updates from Patch Tuesday, then Patch Tuesday blog is the thing to go, where to go. Okay, next up we have a question which Chris has an answer for.
Well, I have a partial answer. So this question came in from Bea, and she had a Netgear Wi-Fi range extender, at least 6 years old, and it actually functioned very well for her, but some kiddies managed to help kill it. And so she's looking for specific recommendations for a replacement on it. She says she uses just a 2.4 gigahertz band on it. So my initial thoughts on it, even though Bea says she only uses a 2.4 gigahertz band, definitely don't look for a Wi-Fi extender that only handles 2.4 gigahertz band, because you may upgrade to wanting to use 5 gigahertz band, potentially even the 6 gigahertz band, although I think most people probably really don't have a need for 6 gigahertz band anytime soon. So the 5 gigahertz band can be very useful because it will give you faster speeds, but at the cost of distance. So if you happen to be very close to either the extender or the Wi-Fi hotspot itself, then you can get better speeds. This is a chart that was put out, I think, out of Wikipedia, about the different Wi-Fi generations, the IEEE standards, and then what the maximum speeds are and the radio frequency. And you'll see the ones that I highlighted in yellow. I would aim for a range extender that supports either Wi-Fi 5 or Wi-Fi 6 as probably the most appropriate. And that you can find them well under $100. I'm saying it's a partial answer because I don't really have any recommendations on it. I don't use the Wi-Fi extender myself, but they are plentiful and they're reasonably priced. And on the other hand, if you actually do go up into either Wi-Fi 6E or 7, you gain the 6 gigahertz band. What does that buy you? Well, it buys you even faster speeds. But, you look at the speeds and you're talking about 10 gigabit. Or 46 gigabit speed, maximum speeds on it. Well, nobody has internet connections that are 46 gigabit And I don't think we're going to see any in the next couple of years.
There's also that the Wi-Fi 7 isn't supported by AMD. So unless you've got Intel, you can't use 7 anyway.
Yeah, but it's going to be coming along for sure, and everybody will be supporting it going forward. But right now, I think that the 6 gigahertz band is overkill for the vast, vast majority of people. So I think most people are well served by Wi-Fi 5 or Wi-Fi 6, and that'll get you up to the speeds that you're able to use on your internet connection as it stands so far, and it gives you both the 2.4 and the 5 gigahertz bands. So I think that we want to look for any other recommendations that people have. So I'm kicking it over to anybody who has experience with Wi-Fi extenders, good or bad. So if you have any recommendations of ones to go for or avoid, things that you're happy with, things that you thought were good deals, things that you thought were too expensive and so forth, what I would suggest is throw it into the chat. And we could sort of revisit at the end of Q&A at the time, or in the very least, B can actually pick up any of the information that people post into the chat. And I think that's it for that.
Well, I've also got some additional stuff, too.
Oh, yes, that's all right.
I was just thinking that we had talked about Wi-Fi extenders a while back, and so I went to see what we had. And just a note, if you're looking for previous material, previous topics that we've covered, if you go to the Q&A webpage and you scroll down, you will find this filing cabinet here, which is the archives. So as well as the actual archives of the presentations and the recordings and the chats, there's also this PDF file, which is an index to the topic. So it's essentially a list of the agenda items from the various Q&A sessions. So here I've gone into the PDF file and I've done a search, a control F, and I'm looking for extender. And you'll see that on December the 4th there was a question on Wi-Fi extenders, and on the 18th there was a follow-up for extenders and analyzers. So there's a lot of information there about different kinds of extenders and how to look for how well they're working in terms of their range in the house and using sniffers and that kind of stuff. So it doesn't actually tell you which one to buy, but it gives a lot of information about the actual technology. The timing for this question is unfortunate, because in October we actually have a presentation from a speaker, Francis Chow, from the APCUG group, on Wi-Fi extenders, routers, and mesh systems, which is a kind of a all singing or dancing extender system where you have a number of Wi-Fi extenders all working in concert, as it were, to create a mesh of Wi-Fi outlets throughout your house.
Can I add something to that?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, the difference between the extender and the mesh is that the mesh transmits to the other nodes, and you don't lose any of the signal. It's still 100%. With the extenders, each one that you put on, you're losing a quarter of the signal each time. So if you add like three or four of them together, you get almost nothing at the end of it.
Yeah, the downside, of course, is that mesh systems are much more expensive. But, you have to use what's going to work in your
particular. Well, I got an Orbi one on sale on Amazon for like a quarter of the price that it was a year ago. So they do come down pretty significantly.
Okay, well, that's good. Well, we'll see what people come up with on suggestions for extenders. I have an interesting follow-up. A few weeks ago, I published this article about the OneDrive client for Linux using using the web-based apps in Office 365 on Linux, but you have to, essentially, you have to use OneDrive to open and save the files. So there is this application called OneDrive Client for Linux, which basically makes that happen. And I got this email essentially from the developer. And the developer is a guy called Alex Brownegg, and he's the maintainer for this client. And he says, thank you for your recent article in the June newsletter. Now, this is interesting because he must have found the article on the web in the newsletter on our website, because I can't imagine how else he would have found out about it. But one of the things he pointed out was my text here, which says, enter the response URI, and I put S-I-C, sick, because I thought that was actually a spelling mistake, and I thought it was supposed to be URL, enter the response URL from the browser. Now, Alex points out that when you enter a URL and it changes, he says it technically becomes a URI, a Uniform Resource Identifier. Now, I've never heard of URIs before, so I went to Mr. Perplexity, and he says, well, a URI uniquely identifies a resource, and a resource can be a location, in which case it would be a URL, but it can also be a uniform resource name, or in fact it can be both. So it's a kind of a general type of item. A URL identifies basically a location on the internet, so a website. So for example, opcud.ca is the URL for our website. That is a URL. But if you have a URN, a name, then that may be something like the identifier for a book. So if you think of an ISBN number for a book, then that could be specified by this string here, URN colon ISBN colon, and then the number of the book. And I think if I remember rightly, that's a book on programming Python. So if you're interested in that, you can check that out. Anyway, there's a subtle difference in my view between a URL and a URN. Now, the other interesting thing was, he says, if you remember, the problem was that when you run this client, you basically have to configure it to access OneDrive. And what happens is you have to authenticate with a Microsoft server the client. So you enter this URL, and it goes to the server, and the server thinks about it, and then it changes the URL in the browser, but it doesn't do anything else. It shows you a blank screen, and you really don't, personally, I didn't realize anything had changed. So it took me a while to figure it out. So he says, I know that this step confuses many users. He's tried to clarify it in the documentation, but he agrees that an image would help, so he's going to think on that. However, he also says that the new version of his client, 2.5.6, supports Microsoft Intune, whatever that is, and Microsoft Zeroauth 2, which is a authorization scheme that, for example, Gmail uses. And that will allow users to do the authentication without having to deal with this URL, URI copying method. So if you're using OneDrive client for Linux, then you might want to have a look at the new version and read the release notes. And finally, he says, thanks for your support and helping share the project with the wider Linux community. Now, that's you, because I wrote a newsletter article for the club, so you must be the wider Linux community. Well done, people.
And Jeff had a comment in the chat. If you use FileZilla Pro, you can access OneDrive account, but each time you run it, you'll have to log into OneDrive with your credentials. You don't get real-time synchronization, but it is an option for syncing with Linux.
Okay. Well, once you figure out how to use OneDrive client for Linux, it's basically transparent, so it works really well. Anyway, talking about OneDrive, is this yours, Chris? Yes.
Yes, I think so. Let me just No, that's not an error. Okay, so getting rid of OneDrive Sync. Ask Leo had a very interesting video. If you're trying to get rid of OneDrive off of your computer, and he talks a little bit about why you might want to get rid of it, and if so, it's not all that difficult to do so, and he found that it was rather painless in his experience that going without OneDrive Sync on his computer worked really well for him. Oops. Okay, click one through. Okay, so he said that OneDrive creates a lot of problems for a lot of users. So he has a lot of people query him about various problems that they're having. And a quote from him is, OneDrive has become a problematic mess for many people. And two of the issues that he really highlighted was the what he called a horrific OneDrive backup feature that he said could lead to data loss. I'm not really sure that that's the case if you're using it properly, but regardless, that's what he said. And then he had OneDrive storage limits that can lead to data loss, and that the problem is that a lot of people, if they have OneDrive Sync turned on, and they may be synchronizing an awful lot of stuff that they don't realize they're synchronizing to OneDrive in the cloud, and you get limited space. I think it's 5 gigabytes for free, and after that you have to start paying, and Microsoft will bug you and tell you that you're running out of space, and a lot of people don't really know what to do about that and may end up just paying money when really what they want is not to be synchronizing all of those files to OneDrive in the cloud and save themselves the money. So I think it's really, really important to understand the difference between what is OneDrive in the cloud and OneDrive Sync to the PC. And that video has a very good overview of this whole process. So OneDrive in the cloud. So if you think about this as just being isolated, that it's just cloud storage. So it's a place that you can store copies of your files where they're safe from local disasters. So if you have fire or theft or tornado going through or anything like that, that wipes out your computer and perhaps wipes out your local backup that is sitting beside your computer and so forth, having files in the cloud can be very, very useful for that. Another use that I really like for cloud storage is the ability to easily share files with others rather than emailing them, gigabyte files or even just huge number of files that maybe they don't want to have show up in their mailbox. You can actually share URLs with them and they just click the link and they can access the files directly. OneDrive Sync is an actual application that is running on your Windows computer, and it allows for two-way synchronization of files between that cloud storage and the local computer. Microsoft, in their infinite wisdom, decided to turn on OneDrive Sync by default and decided to change the default save location for Microsoft Office documents, Word, PowerPoint, Excel, and so forth, to a synchronized folder so that it automatically will sync the files that you're creating up to OneDrive in the cloud. Not only do they do that, they actually name the folder that it's saved to Documents. And you might be forgiven if you just have been using Documents for many versions of Windows and so forth, and you know that it's a local location on your hard drive. Well, it turns out you actually end up with two document folders, one of them being under a OneDrive designation. And at that point, and Peter, I'm going to mute you. Where was that? Yeah, so the behavior ends up that by default, you end up creating all kinds of new documents and so forth that are synchronized in the cloud, and you may not realize that that's the case. And Microsoft decided to also turn on OneDrive backup, all without telling you about it or informing you of what the ramifications are for that. So if you want to turn off OneDrive Sync, Leo details exactly how to go about doing it, making sure that you don't lose any data. So it details how to make sure that your existing files are in a safe place on your computer, that is the place of your choosing, that is not in a folder that is being synchronized to OneDrive in the cloud. And then remove the OneDrive app on your computer to disable the synchronization so that you no longer have that happening automatically. So there's a number of URLs, and I pasted those into the chat. So if you are interested in getting rid of OneDrive or even just understanding a little bit better what OneDrive Sync actually does for or against you, take a look at those URLs. And I think, yeah, that was all I had on that.
Okay, thanks, Chris. I'm talking about Leo and the discussion that we had last week about System Restore. Steve sent us this video, Don't Rely on System Restore. And he basically says, A, it doesn't restore your system. It's basically just backing up the registry. It's unreliable. He turns it off. And it's just not worth it for him, at least. And he suggests that you should be using disk imaging software instead. And I have to say I agree with him because that's basically what my take on System Restore. But I've never had it work for me, so you know, your experience may vary. And speaking of which, Chris has got some better information about System Restore in general.
Yeah, I actually take exception to Leo's take on this. I think that System Restore actually does work. You have to understand what it does and what it doesn't do. Now, there may be some aspects of what it's supposed to do that it doesn't do real effectively, but it is not designed to do what a lot of people think it's designed for. So it was a feature introduced way, way back, Windows Millennium Edition, or ME, maybe where it got its first bad name because so many people had bad things to say about Windows ME. But that goes back 25 years, so it's been around a long time. So
there's also two N's in Millennium.
Oh, thanks. So what does it actually do? So it allows you to revert certain things about your computer's setup, specifically system files, installed applications, registry, and system settings to a previous state. And Microsoft calls that previous state a restore point. Restore points are created when, and this is quote Microsoft, significant system events occur, which is rather vague. But Windows Update will always trigger a restore point for sure. They say installing new software and drivers can trigger an automatic restore point as well. I typically don't see that happening so much anymore, but Windows Update definitely has always triggered a restore point for me. And you can actually manually create a restore point anytime you want, and I'll show you where that is. So what actually gets restored if you restore from a restore point? So system files and settings. So it reverts the Windows system files, installed applications, drivers, and registry settings to the state they were in at the selected restore point when it was created. So it includes changes made by Windows Update, driver installations, software installations, or removals. Programs and drivers that were installed after the restore point was created get uninstalled. And that sort of makes sense. If you're trying to correct a problem on your computer, it might have been created by the installation of a program or a driver. Programs and drivers removed after the restore point will get restored. And again, that sort of makes sense. You have a problem on your computer, maybe it's because you removed a driver or a program on your computer, and that messed things up, so they will get restored. And you can actually scan for what programs will be affected, and I'll show you that. In the Windows configuration, so the settings part of system configuration, such as, and they detail, system services and registry entries are reverted to their previous state. Now, I don't believe that it is all registry entries that will actually get reverted, but they talk about them being system registry entries, and they don't actually detail exactly what gets reverted on that. What doesn't get restored? Your personal files are not touched at all. So documents, photos, music, videos, any folders that you've created, anything like that, doesn't touch them. Doesn't touch any of the files stored in user folders. It doesn't affect the folder structure of your personal folders. So that will all remain unchanged when you do a restore to a restore point. System Restore isn't a backup for personal files. It just does not touch those files, so it's not going to revert any of them to a previous state. It can't be used for disaster recovery, such as a hard disk crash, because it is only doing the things that it said it would do. It's your application, your system settings, and your registry settings that are getting restored. None of that other stuff that is required for a full system recovery. It is a tool specifically for reverting system-level changes. It's really important to understand that. So to configure it, you can go to Settings, Systems, About, and go System Protection, or you can click on the Start button, just type in Restore Point, and you'll get a best match that says Create a Restore Point. Either of those will bring you to Control Panel, older form of configuring things. Sorry, my dialog box covered up. Your tab that you're actually on there is called System Protection. And you'll see that you have all your drives are actually listed, and there is an option there for Configure. So you can click on that, and then if it's not enabled, you can enable it there, and then you can adjust the amount of disk space that System Restore is allowed to use. So in this case, on my computer, it's using up its current usage is 8.65 gigabytes, and I've got it set to 1% of my space on a 1 terabyte drive, so 10 gigabytes is the amount that I'm saying it can actually use for restore points. And it will automatically delete older restore points to make room for new ones. So, using the restore points. So if you wanted to actually restore your system to a previous state, you go to that same dialog box and you click on System Restore. And then you'll get a dialog box that just next is the only option on it. So you click on next. And then it says, restore your computer to the state it was in before the selected event. No, doesn't do that. And that's very poor wording on Microsoft's part. You have to understand what it's going to restore. It's not going to restore your computer completely to the state it was when the restore point was created. Down below, you'll actually see a single restore point typically, and you can click on the show more restore points and it'll show all of the ones that you have available. And I only had two available, and that was because the size of those restore points were sufficient that it didn't have room in the 1% of disk space available to do more than two restore points. So it would automatically delete an oldest one to make room for a newer one. And you can see both of these came from Windows Update. So I did not have any restore points that were created just because I installed new software or something like that. So you select a restore point, and this is really important. Click on the Scan for Affected Programs, and it'll bring up a dialog box which shows you exactly what's going to happen on your installed programs. So the first top box is saying what is going to be removed. So these were applications that were actually installed after this particular restore point was created. And so System Restore is going to remove those programs. It is going to try to reinstall some other things that, and they say, might be restored. So, you know, they might be restored, they might not work correctly, and they might need to be reinstalled. But what it will try to do is put things back in the state that those programs were when the restore point was created. I would make sure that you take a screenshot of that or something so that you have a record of what programs you can expect were removed and what programs you expect may have been reinstalled from previous versions that were on your computer before the restore point was created. And that way you can go through and check each of the programs. If they're not working correctly, I would just remove the programs at that point, reinstall them, and continue on from there. So to do the actual restore, you go back to that previous dialog box, you select the restore point you want to restore from, you click on next, and you follow the prompts. And I'm not going to show you any other screens because I did not want to actually go ahead and restore from a particular restore point, but it's just follow the bouncing ball and continue on. And with any luck, it'll actually solve your problems. So,
Chris, Tom has a comment here in the chat. He says the restore file is for each disk and is stored on that disk.
Yeah, and I personally don't think that there's any point in actually doing restore points for anything other than the system disk. Because what's the point? The registry isn't there. It isn't system-level stuff that gets stored on anything other than the Windows system disk. So I don't know. I just don't see any point in doing a restore point on a non-system disk. So what do you do if Windows won't start? Okay, if Windows fails to start multiple times, and the magic number for multiple is 3, it'll automatically enter the Windows recovery environment. And if you want to force Windows RE to come, basically you just have to cause it to fail on its boot up 3 times. So turn on the computer, at the Windows logo, press and hold the power button for 10 seconds. That'll force a shutdown. Repeat that process 2 more times, and it'll go back to that first bullet point where it fails to start 3 times. On the next startup, Windows should display the automatic repair. So you can do this either using a recovery disk or installation media and insert a USB drive with that installation media on it, boot from it, and click repair your computer. And if you go to troubleshoot, advanced options, system restore, you'll basically get back to that point where you can choose a restore point to recover your system from. And hopefully that'll let you get back into Windows. So does it actually work? So as with all questions related to computers, the answer is that depends. Maybe, maybe not. I've heard from a lot of people, including somebody I know who worked for Microsoft, who said System Restore never worked for them. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I've heard from multiple people that System Restore worked great and it did allow them to recover to a working state computer. So your mileage may vary. I think it's really important to have other means of recovery. So you always should have complete disaster recovery, which the System Restore doesn't give you. And so a full system image backup will give you that. So you should always have that available anyhow, so you can always revert to that. But System Restore might work. I think there's little harm in trying. If you're having a problem with your system, you could try System Restore. For some people, it actually did work for them. And it may work for you as well.
So what percentage would you say it actually does work?
I don't know. I've heard from, I would guess, I've heard specifically from 3-4 people who said that it worked for them. And I've heard from probably 6 people who said that it didn't work for them. Now, I'm wondering how many people that it didn't work for that thought it was doing something that it was never designed to do, such as restoring documents or something like that. I don't know. But there's a significant enough number of people that I've heard from that say it did work for them that I think, at least in some cases, it does work.
Yeah, but my take on it is, though, if you were using a backup and a restore, and it may restore or it may not, would you use your back? Would you rely on that?
Just like the system. I would.
If there was a chance that it probably will work or probably not, it's not reliable enough. You need to know.
No. Because when it comes to security type things, it's all about layers. And so if one thing doesn't work, you go to something else that does work or whatever. Now, to me, one of the reasons why I would not want to necessarily restore from a full system backup, for example, I know somebody who does a backup, full backup of the system once a week. So they could always revert to that, but they could lose up to a week's worth of work because their main working files are on the system disk. And I know Alan will argue about ways of doing it where you don't have your working files on the same disk as your system is in, but a lot of people do that. And so if you have your working files on the same as your system disk and you do a system recovery, in this case of one person, they could lose a week's worth of their work. If they do a system restore and it works, they won't lose any of their files. Now, if it doesn't work, then they can still fall back on that system restore and full system restore. And in that case, yes, they'll end up losing up to a week's worth of work. But maybe System Restore will work for them, and they don't lose any of their data files.
Or you do backups more often.
Yeah, I mean, but that's the thing is there's yeah, you could do it, but you could argue that, well, you have to do backups every hour then. I actually, in fact, do because I do file level backups and things like that that are happening on an ongoing basis on my computers, but a lot of people don't do that. And so this is just one more option, another tool in your toolbox that may help you out.
Yeah. The critical thing there in terms of disk imaging is that it's fine to do a full disk image every week, but as you say, you could lose, you know, 6 days worth of other stuff. So yep. Clearly, you also have to back up the other stuff a lot more frequently.
Yeah, but you know, pinpointing exactly what you need to back up can be really difficult. It's more than just documents, pictures, videos, and desktop. It is an awful lot of stuff that is in hidden folders that are squirreled away by applications or by Windows into locations that you may not consider when you're doing this file level backup on an ongoing basis. So there's a lot of caveats in backup strategies and so forth. I spent 2 hours with a presentation on effective backup strategies where I talk about all of those aspects of it, and you have to decide what's right for you in the processes that you choose to do your backups. And to me, System Restore is just one of those things that falls into that. It's another tool that you can use in your toolbox that may help you with preventing certain data loss that might happen if you use other methods. That's all. So it's not perfect. It's not the be all and end all. It's not the only thing that you can have, but it could be a useful tool. And as I say, there's a number of people who told me that it saved them from having to do a recovery from a full system image backup.
Yeah, there's one comment in the chat that says it saved him. And Harvey says, System Restore works well when the computer is affected by virus or malware infections. Does that ring any bells?
It certainly could, because if it's infecting any of the system level files and so forth on your computer, then presumably it'll revert to previous versions. Now, Windows also always does a pretty good job of protecting its system files anyways, but certainly it's something that, you know, it can help. And as Tom points out, it's easy to just try it first, and if it works, great. If it doesn't, then you revert to other backup tools at your disposal to try to recover the system, ending up, I think the most painful usually is doing a full system restore from a backup image, which is not terribly painful, but, I mean, it is the most painful of all of the options that are at your disposal, I think.
Yes. You need a whole 20 minutes, right?
Yeah, you can restore your whole system with a full, with a system backup faster than the system restore can.
The pain is not so much the work that you would have to do. It's rather waiting for the restore to happen, or the restore of the disk image to happen, assuming that you really don't, any of the things that are stored on the system disk don't matter terribly much to you, except that you want it to work.
Yeah. Okay. Just another tool, folks.
Talking about disk imaging, I don't use Windows that much, and I don't know very much about security settings and whatever was on that first question that everybody thought was the latest and greatest. But the second most important thing people thought they wanted to know about was disk backup and recovery. And so let's think about disk imaging, and we'll start off with just looking at backup. So this is the second item in the polls. Two-thirds of the people said they're interested in this. So I think this is going to be like a four-part mini-series, and we're going to concentrate on ESUS To Do Backup free edition. Notice the free edition. This isn't the paid-for version of this software. And we're going to start off with installation and a full disk backup. So just bear in mind that ESUS To Do Backup is actually a commercial product, so they're trying to sell the software. So when you're searching for ESUS to do backup, I highly recommend you put in free edition. And then when you look at the results, make sure that the link that you're going to is actually pointing to the free edition version rather than the ESUS website, because then it becomes a bit more difficult to find the free version. So if we go to one of these things where we can download the software, the first thing that we see is this big advert. We can say 50% if we buy the software. Well, we're interested in the free edition, remember, so let's hit that little X sign and make that go away. Well, almost goes away, because when we get to the download page, it's still there just in case you change your mind at this point and you want to buy the software after all. But we're interested in that big blue button that says the free edition, free download. So let's hit that guy. And of course, before they let you do anything, they probably want you to enter your email address so they can send you information. You can sign up for a newsletter there, it looks like, and get all kinds of news. If you don't want to, I mean, if you want to do that, fine, just enter an email address and you can always unsubscribe, I would imagine, later on. But if you don't want to bother with that, if you actually close this pop-up window using that X which is highlighted there, you actually bypass that edition and you'll download the free version installer. So we're going to save that to the disk and then we can run it. But notice that initially it only downloads a 3 meg file. And when you actually do the installation, when you activate that executable file, it installs another 178 megabytes. So you end up with a couple of different files. And of course, the 178 is the full-blown package. But while it's once it downloads that 178 megabyte exe file, it actually runs it, executes it immediately, and just have to wait while the progress bar ticks along the bottom there until eventually it says that the installation is complete and you can now start the backup program, the free edition. And of course, the first thing that happens when you load the free edition is it offers you the paid edition. But again, there's an X up in the top right-hand corner here. We can get rid of that. We want to try it before we buy it, certainly, and we may not even be buying it. So here's the main window. Well, lo and behold, there's another offer. We can get 20% off if we buy it right now. But notice down here, there's this little box that says, don't show me this again. So if you try clicking that, it will go away and hopefully it won't come back. However, no guarantees. So this is the main ESUS to do backup screen. I'm interested in a full system backup at this point. So I'm going to hit the create backup. And the first thing it wants to know is, well, what is it that you want to back up? And it's giving you all kinds of options here. Clearly, you can do the files, you can do just the operating system. I want to do a full disk image backup. So I select disk, and now it shows me all the partitions which are on my GPT partition disk. So if I click on this select all thing here, then you notice that all of the partitions are selected to be part of the backup process. So my entire hard drive is going to be backed up in this disk image. Now we could actually click backup now and off we go, except that ESUS has chosen to create this my backups file folder on my D drive, which is my dedicated data drive. I didn't tell it to do that. It just saw it was there and decided it would use it. I actually don't want it there. So I'm going to actually click on this guy so I can bring up this window, which is where I want to save my backup images. And you notice here I can save it to the cloud, for example. But I want to save it to a local drive, and this is going to be an external USB drive. So by default, remember, it chose that it wanted to use my data drive, and it had this My Backups folder, which it created. I'm actually going to scroll down here until I get to a P drive, which is a Western Digital Passport external USB drive. And I'm interested in my Z Images folder, which is where I store all my backup images. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to hit the New Folder button and create a folder underneath Z Images. And I'm going to create a folder called ESUS. So all of my images that I create with ESUS to do backup are going to go into this folder. And you notice that that's all I'm going to do. I'm only going to tell it that I want to use P drive, Z Images, and this ESUS folder, which I just created. I'm going to say OK. All right, so now it's decided that it's going to back up everything on my drive, my 250 gig SSD system drive. It's going to send it to the P drive, Z Images, and ESUS. And now I'm happy, I can just say, okay, back up now, start the backup. When I do that, then it starts telling me how many, what percentage. It's got a progress bar going around the circle here. It tells me how much it's backed up, how quickly it's doing it, and it estimates, and the estimate changes as it goes along. It estimates it's going to take about 30 minutes to create the backup. And once it's finished that, then it says that the backup was successful whenever I did it on the 20th. And I've got 150 gig free still on my hard drive. Okay, and next thing that happens is in the bottom right-hand corner of your desktop, you'll see this guy pop up, which tells you essentially that the backup completed, but it also offers to schedule the task that you've just done. So if you want to, you can run the scheduler independent of this window, but if you want to, you can click on this orange button here and set a schedule, so you can do a full disk image backup every week or every day or every month. Whatever you want to do. Or you can just do it manually when you wish to do so. okay, so here's my P drive. Oops, here is my P drive. And here is the Z Images folder. And here is ESUS, which is the folder I created. But you notice that now ESUS has created a new folder called this zero, which is going to be the backup location for my full disk image backup. And if I open this folder, then you can see underneath that I've got this this PBD file. So it's labeled it as disk zero. The date when I made it, it says it's a full image, and it's a ESUS to do backup file format, which is a PBD file. So now we have a full disk image backup. And next time, we're going to look at a kind of a different take on that. We're going to look at how do we create incremental backup. So rather than do a full disk image backup every time, we're only going to back up the stuff that's changed. And because that's going to be much less in terms of disk space required, we can afford to do that much more frequently. And one of the ways I use this is for my data drive. I do a full backup of the data drive, and then I do a daily scheduled backup of that data drive as an incremental backup. So I get a series of files, the main backup drive, and then subsequently a series of incremental backups that I can use to restore the partition itself or individual files and folders. So it's a very convenient way of making backups. And basically I do three kinds of backups. I do a full disk image backup every month because that kind of lines up with Patch Tuesday. And I always have a fallback to the previous version if the updates go south. I do this daily backup of my data drive. So I've always got at least, I can only lose one day's worth of work. But it's better than that because I also have real-time backup software, which is backing up my data drive as I'm using it. And I also have a fourth one where I do a manual pre-file sync backup to a flash drive. So I've got tons of different backups And I'm pretty confident that I'm not going to lose stuff. Okay, that's it for this week for backup. We'll carry on with that later on. And in the meantime, are there any questions?
Yeah, there was a couple on here. We have one about somebody who tried to use us, and they think they backed up just the OS. So that is something you don't want to do. You want to back up entire drives. Is by far the best approach to take, and make sure that if you have multiple physical drives, when you get to that selection where you're selecting disks, make sure you select every disk that you want to back up, and then every partition on every disk, physical disk that is in your computer. So that's the best approach by far. If the backup succeeded, why no change in space on the backup drive? I'm not sure what it was referring to there. It might be that it just hasn't updated it from that after a backup completes. I'm not sure. That's interesting. We had a question, how much space is needed to backup? Do you need to check that first to ensure your external drive can take the data? And, yeah, that's one sort of maybe a fault that the program has. It will not actually check to see if you have sufficient space available. And I think part of that is because it doesn't know for sure. There's a certain amount of compression that will happen when it's backing up things. So the backup file that is created will usually be a little bit smaller than the total sum of the space that is used on the drives being backed up. But there's no magic number saying 80% size or anything like that. What will happen is that your backup will just fail, and it will tell you that it ran out of space. And then you have to do a cleanup and then go ahead and do the backup again. Now, if you set up tasks, you can configure tasks to do automatic cleanup. So, for example, you can have it that it will keep two backup sets, and it will do a full backup followed by 30 days of incremental backups. Then it will create a new full backup followed by 30 days of incrementals. And then before it creates or after it creates the next full backup, if it creates it successfully, it'll remove the first backup set. So you can set up things so that it will keep things cleaned up automatically for you. I just monitor things on my backup drive so that I do a manual cleanup of it, but there are settings within the program that can help you out in that regard.
Yeah, I was going to say, you are allowed to manually clean up your backup drive too. I usually take a look at how much space is available before I run the backup. But my experience, I don't use ESIS to do backup a lot, but my experience with full disk imaging in general is that I get about 50% compression. And that seems to be the case for Tom here. He's saying that he had a 200 gigabytes of use space, and the PVD size was 107, which is almost 50%.
Yeah, I don't get anywhere near that.
That wasn't mine. That was yours from the slides you show.
Oh, there you go. Okay. I told you I got about 50%.
Yeah, I don't get anywhere near that. I get maybe 20% compression.
You have 10 million photographs.
That's true. They don't compress at all. Yeah, I've got probably several hundred gigabytes worth of photos, and they don't compress. So yeah, that's probably my problem.
Also, most documents these days are compressed. That's why it's .docx. The X means it's compressed. It's actually a zip file. But things that are not compressed are PDFs. And sometimes BMPs, pictures. I don't know what else is less compressed. Also, of course, text files and logs. Those are very compressible.
Yeah, but I think from it's hard to say. You should just run the backup and then check afterwards to see what sort of compression you're getting, just so you know for the future how much space you're going to need for a full backup, and just know that on your system that's typical for your configuration. Unfortunately, there's no magic things that are, and the program doesn't try to predict it. It'll just try to do the backup, and if it runs out of space, it'll fail. And you just have to you can go in and have the program notify you when failures happen and things like that. It's a bit of a pain on that regard. And I think that was it for the questions.
I think so. Okay, so let's do the wrap up then. In terms of the presentations with the public library, we only have a couple for the current series. We'll be starting again in the fall. I think those are all starting now. I think in the pre-meeting that Chris had, a couple are already scheduled. But in the next little while, there's only two, and one is a armchair travel program on Norway by Linda at Alta Vista. And I apologize to Linda here. She has much better photographs than this one of mine, which is a sculpture somewhere in northern Norway.
I like it.
You'll get much better pictures than this when if you go and watch the armchair travel series at Alta Vista. And the other one we have is Fun with Fonts. Chris is doing this one again, Carlingwood, on Monday, June the 30th. And again, if you haven't seen Fun with Fonts, highly recommend it. It sounds as though it's going to be dull and boring, but it's actually really interesting and very well put together.
And I recommend it too. It was very good.
There you go.
Thank you for the votes of confidence.
And next thing we have coming up is next Wednesday, July the 2nd. So we'll be putting our Canada flags back in the closet, I guess. But we will have another Q&A. So if you have questions or you want to share things like some of the shares we've had tonight, or you can answer some of the things we talked about, like what's the best Wi-Fi extender out there right now, or what's the most economical, or the best performing, or whatever. If you have thoughts on things like that, send us an email to suggestion box, and we'll be happy to include them next week. So thanks very much for attending. Hope everybody enjoyed the quite diverse range of materials, and we'll see you next Wednesday.
Thanks for showing up, folks. We'll see you next week.